You have the one side outline on Dostoevsky. I want to give you a little context, Dostoevsky's life, the novel from which your reading comes, called The Brothers Karamazov. I want to then look at the story of Jesus and the Grand Inquisitor within this. So let's begin with a few things about Fyodor Pavlovich Dostoevsky, born in 1821 in St. Petersburg, Russia. As a young man, Dostoevsky was interested in the new ideas coming from the West, from Europe, coming into Russia, and especially via St. Petersburg, that great city. One thing about his father that is important to the novel, perhaps not to the story as we're reading it. Dostoevsky's father, who was a somewhat authoritarian and cruel man, was murdered by his serfs, by the bonded servants on his estate, beaten to death. And this haunts much of Dostoevsky's writings, this death of his father. He became a writer. He became a very popular writer, respected in the small world of Russian intellectual society, focused in that capital on the West, because St. Petersburg was the capital, Peter the Great's great city, his window to the West. And Dostoevsky was involved with other young men who liked to drink and beer and talk ideas, and it was that kind of intellectual ferment coming into Russia. They weren't revolutionaries, they weren't radicals, but that wasn't the Tsar's secret police's view of them. And so these young men in their 20s were arrested, taken to prison, tried, and sentenced to be executed. The day before Christmas, they were all taken out, lined up in the public square, and the firing squad marched in. At that moment, a rider on a horse galloped in, waving a pardon from His Gracious Majesty the Tsar. Well, the whole thing was a fraud. The pardon, well, it wasn't a pardon. It was a transmutation of execution to 10 years of labor in Siberia. But that had been worked out months before. All this man on a horse, that was pure drama stuff. But it had its effect. The man in front of Dostoevsky fell down insane. Dostoevsky had the first of his lifelong series of grand mal epileptic seizures. And so he was convicted. He was sent to Siberia, and he spent 5 years in a Siberian prison. And the second half of his sentence, he was made a buck private in the Russian army on the Mongolian border. When he came back to St. Petersburg, the intellectual capital of Russia, when he came back, he was a changed man. And irony of ironies, he had become, in many ways, what the Tsar wanted. He had become a conservative. He had become a Christian of an Orthodox kind, not a Catholic, not a Protestant, but an Orthodox Christian. He had become a Slavophile. If you want to hear more about that, it'll have to wait till the Russian Lit class this spring. But he came back and he began to write his series of novels for which he is famous to us. Notes from Underground, you see some titles on your outline. Notes from Underground, Crime and Punishment, The Idiot. Idiot was a term used for epileptics in 19th century Russia. So Prince Myshkin is an epileptic, not an idiot in our usual sense of the term. And then culminating in that last novel published the year before Dostoevsky died, called The Brothers Karamazov. In 1880, he published this novel, died in 1881. You can see the statue of him that stands now in St. Petersburg. Sorry, the lights are so bright today. Let's talk about context to our reading, because it's an excerpt out of a much, much larger novel. It's a story of three brothers, Ivan, Dmitry, and Alyosha. Oh, yeah, maybe there might be a fourth brother, too. That's a complex issue. You have to read the novel to find about find out about Smerdyakov, whose name means stinky. We're concerned with only two out of the three brothers, and in my rereadings of this novel, I would say that the brother we don't even get a glimpse of, Dmitri, is the main character. That wasn't Dostoevsky's view, but that's okay. He's not always right. But let's talk about these two brothers that we do meet in this opening chapter. Ivan, young man in his 20s, and Alyosha, a young man in his late teens, because Dostoevsky was writing here and investigating partly the problems of personality, partly the problems of what it means to live existentially in a certain way. If you were to go out and live with wild abandon, if you were to listen to Nietzsche, if you were to say, there is no God, there are no values, all values have collapsed, I can do anything I want, anything I can get away with, what would happen? What would be the result if you really passionately lived that way? That's Dmitri. Now, what if you were the perfect Core 250 student who absorbed all the ideas and lived a life of passionate intellect, looking at the ideas of the 20th century that says reason doesn't lead to God, there probably isn't a God, values are collapsing, what's left is, well, what is left if there is no God? This is Ivan, the young man of intellect. On the other hand, what if you were a young man, a teenager, a young man of faith who has dedicated his life to God? That's Alyosha. Alyosha has dedicated his life, and he's a novice monk. He's living in the monastery. Now, each of these brothers, and this is one of the points of the novel structurally, each one undergoes a terrible crisis, a crisis on his own terms. What's a crisis for one wouldn't be a crisis for the other, but they each go through a terrible crisis during their lifetime. And we watch as that's happening. Okay, that's the big backdrop. Now the immediate backdrop, we've got two brothers, Ivan and Alyosha. And you may be surprised to learn, they don't really know each other. They have grown up because of their different mothers. They have grown up in different towns. They are now meeting as young adults. And in your reading, they have come together in a restaurant, and they are going to talk. And one of the great things about reading Dostoevsky is he really lets things happen. You know, you're going home for Thanksgiving, and you know that a lot of arguments could happen around your Thanksgiving table, but you're all very polite and middle class and Presbyterian, and they won't happen. In a Dostoevsky novel, they do happen. These two brothers now confront each other, and they really like each other. And Ivan is excited to tell his ideas. Ivan, the intellectual, the skeptic, is going to tell his ideas to his young brother, whose life is a life of faith, who is a young monk on his way to becoming a monk. And what does he talk about? What does Ivan talk about? He talks about suffering. He talks about the suffering particularly of innocent children. He says, let's not talk about adults. We've all eaten of the apple. We all know we're all corrupted already. But let's talk about innocent kids. And he's got some clippings in his wallet that he takes from the newspapers. And he comes up with stories that you could have heard on the news in Spokane this week. You could have read in the Spokesman Review. Maybe Russian versions of them, 19th century versions. But they're so like what we have seen. We've got these terrifying stories. I don't know how you felt, but I was rereading it last night, and I just got overwhelmed once again at these stories where Ivan says, here's this story of these parents who have this little kid. She's just a little kid, and she hasn't learned not to wet the bed. She can't hold it at night. And they mistreat her, and they beat her, and they beat her with sticks that have thorns sticking out of them because it stings worse. And he talks about the near sexual ecstasy that the father goes into in beating his child. Hey, that's ordinary, everyday stuff in Spokane. And he talks about how the girl has messed her pants and her mother sticks it on her face and in her mouth and locks her in the outhouse in the cold. And she sits out there freezing all night saying, oh, dear God, oh, dear God. That's ordinary, every week suffering that we can find in our communities. And why is Ivan telling this to Alyosha? He has said, if, Alyosha, you could construct a world in which everybody was happy except one little kid. Everybody's happiness was bought at this very small price. One little kid was absolutely miserable. Would you do it? And Alyosha says, no, I wouldn't. And Ivan says, I wouldn't either. And the unspoken statement is, so how can you believe in a God who did? Where not just one kid suffers, but most kids suffer. Or many thousands of kids suffer, like the stories he's telling about the boy on the landed estate of the great landowner with his favorite dogs, and he's got 100 boys just to take care of the dogs, and one of them has thrown a stone and wounded his favorite dog's paw. So he takes the boy out, strips him naked in front of all the servants and his parents, and sicks the dogs on him, who tear him to pieces in front of his parents. All right, that's pretty terrible. But we can find stories of that equivalent nature in our newspapers. How can you believe in a God who has created a world in which there is this kind of suffering? Suffering of innocence. That's the context. And reading this story, I think of it as like boxes within boxes within boxes. It's like those Russian dolls. You open up one and you find another inside. You open that and you find another one inside. You've got Dostoevsky who's writing. He's writing The Brothers Karamazov. In The Brothers Karamazov, we have the character Ivan. The character of Ivan is telling a story about the Grand Inquisitor. And then the Grand Inquisitor in the story is giving an explanation of the temptations of Jesus. It's dolls within dolls within dolls. Because what is Dostoevsky's relationship to the Grand Inquisitor's story? We have to get to that at the very end. So, Ivan tells a legend. He tells a story before this about the Blessed Virgin Mary. You remember? Who goes to hell, sees all the sufferings, goes up to heaven, pleads with God to relieve the sufferings of those in hell. And God says, okay, for a couple of weeks a year, I'll relent. No sufferings in hell. And all the saints and angels fall down and say, thou art indeed just, O Lord. Ivan says, oh, but I live in a modern, ironical age. I've got to tell a different kind of story. So I made up this story about 16th century Seville in Spain, about the Grand Inquisitor. Well, what was a Grand Inquisitor? Who was the head of the Inquisition? That body of the Roman Catholic Church that made sure that faith was pure even at the cost of arresting, torturing, burning people at the stake to make sure that the pure faith was unsullied, was untouched by heresy. And when we look at this, what do we expect of a Grand Inquisitor? What do we think he's going to be like? Is he going to be a sweet leader of the church? Here's El Greco's painting of the cardinal head of the Inquisition in the year 1600. We expect probably somebody who gets some deep pleasure out of torturing people. Maybe even some deviant sexual pleasure out of seeing people torn apart or burned at the stake. That's our expectation, and Dostoevsky, I think, wants us to have that expectation, because, of course, it's wrong. He likes to play against our expectations. And so, when we look at Ivan Karamazov's Grand Inquisitor, what do we find? Well, in his conversations with Jesus, we find that he is very different from this sadistic expectation that we have concocted. He really talks to Jesus and says, you know, Jesus, the problem with you, you didn't love people enough. We love people more than you did. And let's watch how he says this, how he explains this. Basically, he gives us the revised version of the temptations in the wilderness from Luke's gospel. And you remember that in the gospel story, Jesus has gone out into the wilderness for that time of testing, that 40 days and 40 nights, and he's hungry. And at the end of his time of solitude and testing, the evil spirit, Satan, appears before him and says, Jesus, you're hungry. Here's temptation number one. Turn the stones around you into bread. You don't have to be hungry. Just do your magic. Do your mojo. Turn the stones into bread. And then he says, secondly, Jesus, you want to be famous? You want people to believe in you? Go into Jerusalem and jump off the highest building that exists. Jump off the temple. Because, of course, you know, as the Son of God, God will send legions of angels to catch you, and everybody will know that you are the favored one, the Messiah, the Son of God. You are the Christ. And the third temptation is, Satan says, bow down before me, and I will give you all the kingdoms of the world. I will give you the authority over all the kingdoms. That's the story that all of us have read in Luke's gospel. I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, I grew up in Sunday school. I went to a parochial school. I learned catechism and had Bible history every day. But, you know, I never understood the temptations. I got taught that that Jesus was tempted in all things like unto us and yet without sin. That famous phrase. I was never tempted to jump off the temple, turn stones to bread. I was tempted to steal candy out of the candy store. I was tempted to lie. What relation do Jesus' temptations ever have to me? Well, I would say I never understood anything about the temptations till I read Dostoevsky. This made more sense of them than anything in school or church had ever made. What does the Grand Inquisitor do with these temptations in his revisionist interpretation? Oh, yes. At the end of the three temptations, Jesus says, get thee behind me. Get out of here. Leave me, Satan. Man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. Let's look at the Grand Inquisitor's true meaning of the temptations. This is what they really meant, he says. The temptation to turn stones into bread, Jesus, you had the chance to dazzle everyone with your power. If you had turned the stones into bread, everyone would follow you because we will follow whoever gives us the earthly bread. And Jesus, the Grand Inquisitor says, you blew it. You had your chance and you failed. Second temptation was to jump off the temple. Jesus, you could have shown everyone that you were the Son of God. No one would have a problem of faith or doubt. Everyone could know, simply know, that you were the one sent from God because the angels had caught you. And Jesus, you refused. Jesus, you blew it. You failed. And what does he say about these that we really want? The Grand Inquisitor says, we want someone to worship. That's what we want. We don't want the hard faith that you have given us, Jesus. We want it easy. We want someone to worship. That's why you should have turned the stones into bread. And secondly, we want someone to keep our conscience. And by that he means somebody who's going to tell us this is right and that is wrong and follow the rules and you'll be happy and it's easy. Faith is easy. Just follow the rules. Jesus, you were unwilling. Jesus, you are cruel and unloving, is the implication of what the Grand Inquisitor says. And third, he said, you had the chance to bow down and receive authority over all the kingdoms of the world. That is, to give us some leader. That's what we want more than any other thing. We want someone to worship, someone to tell us right and wrong, and someone to lead us, to give us a society, a state, a kingdom, whatever it is, to give us some means of universal unity, because that's what we want and need. Jesus, these are the three things that humanity most wants and needs, and you failed us. What we really want and what we really need as a human race is miracle, mystery, and authority. The three big words here. Miracle, turn the stones into bread. Give us someone to worship. Mystery, jump from the temple and get caught. Give us someone who will tell us right from wrong. Keep our conscience. Give us guidance and authority. We want some authority figure who will tell us what to do because we are terrified. Jesus, you refused to give us the three things we want and need, and you gave us that one thing we don't want and cannot use, freedom. All of this, the Grand Inquisitor is saying to Jesus. Let's back up enough to give the setting to this. In Ivan Karamazov's story in Spain during the Inquisition, Jesus showed up on the street, didn't he? And it wasn't a secret. Everybody knew it was Jesus. Nobody was confused. They all saw right away. And Jesus went and did what we saw him do in the Gospels. He healed the sick and he raised the dead. And the Grand Inquisitor, who yesterday had burned 100 people in a great auto da fe, in a great burning, in the name of the true faith, he has arrested Jesus. And like everybody else, he knows exactly whom he has arrested. He's not mistaken. He knows it is Jesus. And in this interview, Jesus has chosen to say nothing, just as he did before Pilate. He says not a word. And the Grand Inquisitor explains the temptations as I just went over them and says what we need is miracle, mystery, and authority. And instead, Jesus, you betrayed humanity by not loving us enough. You gave us what we don't want, what we can't use, this terrifying burden of freedom. The Grand Inquisitor has talked on, and Jesus, as we know, has said not a word. At the end of it, the Grand Inquisitor looks at him and says, what do you think? And Jesus, still not saying a word, goes up and kisses him on the lips. Of course, we think right away of the Garden of Gethsemane and Judas kissing Jesus. But this is such a different kind of kiss than the Judas kiss, isn't it? What is the meaning of the kiss? And then, when the story's over, Ivan Karamazov looks at his brother Alyosha, the monk, and says, what do you think of my story? Like so many creative writers, he wants feedback right away. And Alyosha says to his brother, he kisses him, doesn't he? Well, let's look at the two kisses. And Ivan's response. The first kiss, you know, the Grand Inquisitor said that Jesus gave us freedom. And you know, he's partly right in his analysis then. Jesus did give us freedom. Dostoevsky agrees with the Grand Inquisitor on this, that Jesus gives us the terrifying burden of freedom. But the kiss is more than that. The kiss is also an act of affirmation and of love. So if Jesus kisses the Grand Inquisitor, he is saying, you have the freedom to be totally wrong. disastrously wrong, eternally wrong. But you have that freedom. And at the same time, he gives him the warmth of a kiss. In a society, we have to remember as Americans, men are not comfortable kissing other men. But in, especially in 19th century Russia, this was not a problem. Men kissed other men. So it's a very simple act, not embarrassing to anybody. Jesus kisses the Grand Inquisitor, and then comes that amazing sentence. Listen to it as a Core 250 student. The Grand Inquisitor, Dostoevsky, Ivan Karamazov writes, the old man, the kiss burned in his heart, but the old man clung to his idea. The kiss burned in his heart, but the old man hung on to his idea. Notice the head and the heart here. He has been moved by the act, the kiss that he has received from Jesus. He has been stirred by it. He knows there's something powerful and truth-telling in it. But he hangs on to his rational concept that what we need is miracle, mystery, and authority. We don't want all this freedom. When Ivan Karamazov turns to his brother and kisses him, when Ivan turns and asks him, what do you think? Alyosha kisses him. And once again, we have the same meaning to the kiss, don't we? That Alyosha gives his brother freedom because Alyosha doesn't see the world this way, but he also gives him affirmation and love. Alyosha, along the way, has made a telling statement about the Grand Inquisitor. He has recognized that the Grand Inquisitor, in his analysis of human beings, has left out one crucial factor. He says, but the Grand Inquisitor doesn't believe in God. He may be one of the princes of the church, the leaders of the church in the West, and yet he really doesn't believe in God anymore, does he? The Grand Inquisitor himself says to Jesus, we figured out centuries ago how wrong you were, Jesus. And we, the church, have corrected that. We're now working for the other side. The other side that really is the side that says, we will give humanity's miracle, mystery, and authority because once they die, there's nothing going to be there anyway. Let's make them happy while they're here. The Grand Inquisitor doesn't believe that there is an afterlife anymore, so let's take care of the emotional, social needs of humanity along the way. Alyosha listens to his brother and believes that there is a God, and that makes all the difference. And his kiss is a kiss of affirmation and of love, but also a kiss of freedom. That you can be free to go on and to say what you think. And I will stay with you. And if you read the whole novel, this one of the greatest of all novels, you find out what happens between these two brothers, what happens among these three or even four brothers in the great story here. To close this, let's take it back to Dostoevsky. Dolls within dolls within dolls. We've got the Grand Inquisitor. Does the Grand Inquisitor represent Dostoevsky's view? Not at all. Dostoevsky, who came back from Siberia a changed man, looked at his colleagues and said, these people are so critical of the church, the Russian Orthodox Church. They're critical of Christianity. They're critical of everything. They bring these Core 250 kinds of Western intellectual concepts, Nietzschean concepts. Of course, Nietzsche didn't exist yet. Dostoevsky hadn't read Nietzsche, but Nietzsche had read Dostoevsky. But I'm just using Core 250 language. all of these things that have come, the Grand Inquisitor represents some of those ideas that are in Ivan Karamazov's head. And Dostoevsky says, no, there's something else, there's something more. And he says two things. It's not on my PowerPoint. First thing he says is salvation through suffering. When I first heard this, I was 19 years old, and I was reading Crime and Punishment, and I heard this, and it sounded so like, earn your way to heaven if you're poor and oppressed and suffering. And I thought, that's too shallow. And it was, because I'm sure now as an adult that that's not what Dostoevsky meant. What I think that he meant, and what we can see in his great novels, is that God's grace comes often when we are most vulnerable. Most of the time, we have spent a great deal of time, effort, and money to protect ourselves, to insulate ourselves. We take out insurance policies. We do everything we can, and certainly I do, everything we can to protect ourselves from suffering. I don't want suffering in my life. But Dostoevsky says salvation and God's grace probably has the greatest access to us at times when our armor has been cracked, at times when we are suffering and God can get through to us. The other thing that Dostoevsky says, and here he is a real existentialist too, he says, if I could be convinced that all truth was over here and Jesus was over here, I would choose Jesus. Now, when I was 20 years old, I thought that was beautiful. I thought that was wonderful. That excited me. But as an adult, I listen to that and I say, Dostoevsky really seems to think that truth and God can be separated, which scares me. That there is a world of truth over here in which I have invested my life as a teacher, as an intellectual. And then maybe God is over there? What does that mean? I'm not sure. But it seems that Dostoevsky is able to think that way because he is so critical of the rationalist tradition. He is so opposed to all of this Western European liberalism, not in the political sense, but the liberalism represented by the kinds of ideas we've been looking at here, the positive views of human nature, all of that he is so critical of. Read Notes from Underground, and you have a man who hates Western intellectual optimism, such as characterizes most people in this room, certainly me. So Dostoevsky challenges us deeply. In some ways, he looks like he reassures us because he's so profoundly Christian. On the other hand, his kind of Christianity says, suffering is coming your way. The question is what you're going to do about it. And most of that suffering comes from the fact of your freedom. And the Grand Inquisitor is right. You will do almost anything to get rid of that burden of freedom. That terrifying burden.